Art.org Advanced Career in Teaching, convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Here's a favorite interview from the WGTD archives. For the next few minutes, we are going to explore the extraordinary life and career and legacy and influence of George Carlin. Love him or hate him, you cannot argue that George Carlin made an enormous difference in America's cultural landscape and particularly in the world of comedy. It is really hard to think of any single figure who was actually more significant in terms of pushing the envelope, broadening horizons, and so on. And some would say to the great benefit of our collective life, and some would say to our moral peril, and probably every verdict in between has been rendered on the work and legacy of George Carlin. A really interesting biography of George Carlin and an examination of his work has just been published, and of course the timing is so propitious. The book is called Seven Dirty Words, The Life and Crimes of George Carlin. The book is by James Sullivan, who is a regular contributor to the Boston Globe. He has written previous books, including The Hardest Working Man, which was about the musician James Brown. And he served for a time as pop music and culture critic at the San Francisco Chronicle, has written for Rolling Stone magazine, among others. And this very well-timed book is a really interesting look at George Carlin, who he was, his journey as a comedian, and probably some of the forces that helped shape who he was. It's published by Da Capo Press, and it includes some photographs that help to bring this story even more vividly to life. James Sullivan, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
We might as well get this first matter out of the way as we talk about the amazingly good timing of your book and, for that matter, this interview. As I'm sure many of our listeners know, just a few days ago, the 13th of July, a court ruling was made regarding an FCC regulation, which was deemed by a three-judge panel to be unconstitutionally vague. Can we start there and just kind of summarize for our listeners, to whatever extent you feel comfortable, what that ruling was, the regulation they're talking about, and how that intersects with the infamous George Carlin?
Sure. Well, in this particular case, the FCC was ruling on what they're calling fleeting expletives, which, to the FCC's mind, are the occasions when people in the media let slip with four-letter words or words that, you know, are deemed, you know, offensive, can be deemed offensive in our culture. So in this case, it was particularly rooted in the singer Bono from U2 accepting an award several years ago on live television at an awards show and saying, "This is, you know, effing brilliant," or something to that effect, and just blurting it out. So in that regard, there's a distinction. I mean, it's specifically talking about blurted expletives on live television, which, by the way, you can pretty clearly hear consistently on any network professional sports broadcast, because the athletes swear all the time, and pretty often they're pretty close to a microphone, and you can hear it, and it doesn't, you know, somebody manages not to catch the bleep in time. But so what the ruling was essentially stated that the FCC has been trying to fine the television stations that broadcast the live shows where the fleeting expletives occur hundreds of thousands of dollars. And all of the broadcast networks have essentially banded together to fight that ruling. And what the court did was basically struck it down and just said the FCC isn't being clear enough with regard to which words are going to be offensive enough to get the station slapped with, you know, a $500,000 fine or whatever the case might be. Now, what's kind of funny about this in regard to George Carlin is that this we're talking about unscripted, blurted swear words, and in Carlin's case, he never really uttered an unscripted, blurted swear word on any kind of media anywhere. I mean, George Carlin was one of the most scripted comedians. I mean, he was very, very much in tune with comedy as a craft, and he looked at it as a writerly pursuit. And he, you know, really spent an awful lot of time crafting his routines. And the routine that my book is named after, Seven Dirty Words, which is what fans sort of casually call the routine. It's actually called Seven Words You Can Never Say on Television, which came out in 1972. You know, that was a well-scripted routine that he developed, continued to develop over the many long years of his career after he originally put it out there in 72. So it's kind of unusual, and he would probably be getting a kick out of it were he alive today, that the court system is still, you know, arguing whether four-letter words are permissible or whether the FCC has the jurisdiction to slap hands and charge fines. The original court case over the Carlin routine, the seven words routine, was about a listener-supported station in New York playing the routine in 1973 during a program. I'll try to be brief about this, but about the nature of language. And the program actually started about the nature of language during wartime. You know, what do we call offense? What do we call defense? What, you know, what during the Vietnam era was termed a revolution? And the host was really just questioning our use of words and saying, do we overuse them? Do we strip them of their power when we overuse certain words? And then a caller called in and said, you know, that sounds a lot like George Carlin's routine about dirty words and how he's analyzing those words and, you know, just questioning the nature of those words. And so the host agreed and played the routine. The FCC reprimanded the station, didn't even fine the station, just reprimanded them. But the station was a small enough, you know, nonprofit station that was concerned about its status enough that, you know, they didn't want to get slapped with another reprimand and be taken off the air by the FCC. So they challenged the ruling. And ultimately, the Supreme Court ended up deciding in favor of the FCC, oddly enough, which, you know, during my research, it was kind of funny to note that many people involved on the side of free speech tend to think of the Carlin case in the 70s as a victory for free speech, when in fact the Supreme Court ruled in 1978, 5-4, that the FCC did have the jurisdiction to reprimand stations or otherwise fine them if it saw fit to when four-letter words were broadcast over the air. And what the FCC at the time was loath, as it often is, to appear to be censoring. They hate that word censoring. Everybody tends to hate the word censoring, including the FCC. So what they were arguing was that they really just wanted to relegate the use of four-letter words on listener-supported stations, non-commercial stations, to the after hours when presumably children wouldn't be in the listening audience.
Hmm.
Go ahead.
It was a tight vote, of course, at the Supreme Court of 5-4,
mm-hmm.
and you include some excerpts from the writings on mm-hmm. The decisions written on both sides of that
right.
question. Evidently, part of what entered into the proceedings or into the initial discussions, at least, was a distinction between indecent and obscene,
mm-hmm.
which really underscores just how kind of complicated this gets when you start to write regulations to
right.
to deal with this kind of thing.
Very complicated. And, I mean, in the case of Carlin, the court essentially, certain members of the court went back to the ruling in the 60s about what constitutes obscenity. And basically, the Supreme Court has typically tends to say that any kind of art cannot be deemed obscene if it has redeeming social value. And so, in the case of the Carlin routine, the defense attorneys, you know, hung on that heavily. They really wanted to push the point that Carlin was not just gratuitously saying the words, the four-letter words, for shock's sake, but was really, you know, was almost using the words, analyzing the words in an educational manner. Was really just questioning language and our attitude towards it in our American culture, and just saying, what is it about these words? I mean, essentially, the bottom line of the routine was, what is it about these words that makes us fear them and makes us, you know, pretend to our children that they don't exist, when clearly the kids, especially in our day and age, more so than in the early 1970s, are going to grow up. There's no way they're not going to hear these words by the time they're, let's say, you know, 10 or 12, much less 15 for sure. So, you know, it is absolutely a sticky issue. It's very difficult to parse the issue.
And this is what you write about George Carlin's reaction to that 5-4 ruling of the Supreme Court, which, as you remind us, was essentially against George Carlin and those who favored more unbridled free speech. Mm-hmm. For Carlin, although the outcome was disappointing, his indirect involvement in a landmark case of American jurisprudence felt like a validation. Mm-hmm. After all those years of being called in front of the principal, the priest, the barrack sergeant, and the boss, those transgressions suddenly seemed like small potatoes. That these nine men had summoned me into their presence to question my conduct absolutely thrilled the perverse and rebellious side of my nature, Carlin said. I thought, even if I just become a little footnote in the law books, I'll be a happy footnote forever.
He absolutely. Well, one of the key things to this case for Carlin and his career was that he himself was not on trial. It was a piece of his work that was on trial, and it was the radio station that chose to play it that was on trial. And, you know, Carlin's comic hero, clearly was Lenny Bruce, who famously was arrested multiple times on stage for uttering, you know, so-called obscenities. And it ruined his career, not only his career, but his life eventually, because Lenny Bruce chose to fight his own charges in court as, you know, representing himself as his own attorney. And he, you know, famously became so bogged down in legal issues and so obsessed with the legal issues that he wore himself out and was dead by the age of 40. And Carlin felt, I think, a little bit lucky that, you know, his he raised the issue again several years after Lenny Bruce's death about, you know, why do we fear obscene, you know, indecent words, and but was able to sort of step aside and watch the process work its way through the courts and through the FCC without actually being on trial himself. So that's a key component. And the other thing is that, you know, from 1966, the year of Lenny Bruce's death, up through the 70s, I mean, the culture clearly changed a lot. I mean, Lenny Bruce became well-known in the 50s and early 60s when, you know, we pretty famously had a kind of a clamped-down culture. And the American people didn't seem quite ready for a guy like Lenny Bruce talking so frankly. And only a handful of years later, when Carlin did the routine, there were a lot more people who were a little more prepared to hear the him talk frankly about language. And funny story, the first time that Carlin got into trouble for the seven words routine was in Milwaukee when the album first came out in 1972. He was performing on a summer concert stage at a festival in Milwaukee, and
right,
he got arrested on stage for doing the routine. And when the case went to trial, civil trial later that year, he was not required to appear himself in court. So what his defense lawyers did was played the routine from the album in the courtroom, and the judge at the time later said, it was all I could do to stop from giggling. And everybody in the courtroom was essentially trying to stifle giggles while the routine was going on. So it was fairly clear what the outcome of that case was going to be, because, everybody in the courtroom understood implicitly that there was educational, there was socially redeeming value to what Carlin had to say about language.
Right. And so the contrast between how this played out for George Carlin versus how sort of the same thing played out for Mr. Bruce just a few years earlier tells us a lot about the change in the cultural landscape. I'm glad you brought up Milwaukee. The occasion of George Carlin's arrest happened right up the road from our studios and on the stage of the then relatively new Summerfest.
Right.
Your book describes the circumstances under which that arrest happened.
Mm-hmm.
Tell our listeners a little bit about who police officer Elmer Lentz was.
Well, he was, you know, he seemed to be out for the comedian. I mean, he was, you know, he was he's claimed later that he had his family in the audience. Carlin's own wife and daughter were there. You know, Summerfest is a you know, outdoor event with multiple events going on and carnival sort of atmosphere. And so Carlin's daughter was apparently being chaperoned by someone during the set out by the rides. And Officer Lenz's family was supposedly somewhere in attendance. He was off duty that night, if I remember correctly. And but he was, you know, when he heard. Carlin's was on the main stage, which was obviously amplified. It was typically used for, you know, rock bands at the festival. But, you know, Carlin, being a big sort of rock star level comedian at the time, was given a set, a headlining set on one of the nights of the festival. And the officer heard the routine broadcast over the speakers and immediately became incensed because he claimed, you know, my wife and children are here somewhere. They need to listen. They're being forced to listen to that. He went storming up on stage. The other officers who were working the backstage detail at the festival sort of kept him from. He was prepared to run on stage and just slap the handcuffs on Carlin right at the moment. What happened was the other officers who were working backstage, it seems like, tended to be a little more lenient, probably because they were getting used to working backstage. excuse me, with the rock bands. Which in 1972, you can imagine what might have been going on under the police officers' noses.
Right. Well, and you tell us that they'd been instructed that their function, more than anything, was to protect the performers, not mm-hmm. to arrest them, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. to protect the performers from maybe unruly members of the audience.
Right.
But Officer Lentz was, of course, seeing his role in that moment in very, very different fashion.
Right. So the officers who were backstage kept the Officer Lenz from running on stage, but as soon as Carlin came off, he arrested him. And they tried to get the case tried as a criminal trial, and the Attorney General wasn't particularly interested. So they ended up getting a civil charge in the halls of city government against Carlin, and that's the case that went to trial later that year. And you know, that's the case where the record was actually played in the courtroom.
Hmm. A last thought about this particular matter.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you tell us is that, and we've already said it, is that one reason this matter played out so differently for George Carlin versus Lenny Bruce is
right.
that America was a different place by this mm-hmm. point in time. But your book also points out that the way George Carlin went about talking about this mm-hmm. matter was also a little bit different,
mm-hmm.
And that there was a way in which this routine, although, you know, by no means did everybody love it, obviously, mm-hmm. to this day, there are probably plenty of people who are still mm-hmm. bothered by a lot of this, but that there was something about the way George Carlin made this go down easy
mm-hmm.
that made it a little more palatable.
Well, I mean, besides the educational factor, the fact that he was analyzing language, you know, he made it funny, which is, you know, kind of the point of the book and the point of Carlin's whole life and career. You can address any topic, any issue, no matter how touchy, if you include an element of humor, and that's exactly what he did. Now, with Lenny Bruce, when Lenny Bruce, you know, he knew he was a target, and when he was on his, you know, sort of crusade to open up minds to the fact that words alone can't hurt people unless they're used, you know, directly as an insult. If they're just stated, they're not inherently hurtful like a rock or a weapon or something, which was his point. But one of the things that Lenny Bruce did was essentially just got on stage and just repeated offensive words and said, you know, multiple times over, and just said, if I say this word, ba-dum, 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 10 or 15 times, it sort of loses its power, which is not necessarily inherently funny. It's just making a point. Carlin's routine was actually funny because he sort of broke down the words, analyzed them individually, and, you know, just really sort of, you know, opened up the door to looking at our absurd, you know, our sort of what he thought was our hypocritical attitude towards words, where we use them when, you know, you sort of stub your toe, you'll use it, but then, you know, then again, you turn around and tell your 18-year-old son that he shouldn't be using the same word when he stubs his toe, for instance, or something like that. But so, interestingly, the Lenny Bruce thing, when he repeated the words, that approach to trying to, sometimes it's called defanging the words, taking the teeth out of the words, that's been used more recently in derogatory terms towards racial, sexual, ethnic groups that are, you know, where words mean something of an insult towards a group. And in recent years, the groups have taken the words, whether it's the N-word or queer for homosexuals, just to use two examples. And the groups themselves start using the words to identify themselves. In other words, reclaiming the words and saying, you know what, the more we use this word, the less meaning it has for you people who are using it, trying to use it as a derogatory comment towards us. So that kind of is a sort of a direct descendant of Lenny Bruce's approach, but Carlin's approach was definitely much more about crafting a comic routine about the words.
And this is how you close the chapter in which you, among other things, talk about George Carlin's arrest in Milwaukee back in 1972. At the end of your discussion, you say, seven words, that is his routine, hammered away at the deepening wedge between the generations. But the routine, like almost all of Carlin's self-expressive comedy at the time, also helped explain the counterculture to the mainstream audience. Mm-hmm. Language, hair, getting high, opposing the war, all could be reduced to trivialities and made more acceptable in the process. For Carlin, the symbolic seven words changed everything. From then on, he would forever be known as the comic who shattered the language barrier, for better or for worse. Lenny Bruce, that is, Carlin once observed, was the first one to make language an issue, and he suffered for it. I was the first one to make language an issue and succeed with it.
Right, and that's what I was saying earlier, is that the culture seemed a little more prepared to hear this argument about language, even just 6 years or so down the road from Lenny Bruce's passing. And so what's interesting about Carlin's career, one of the many interesting things I find, is that right around that time, he was going through what he felt like was a pretty public transformation. He had been, kind of surprisingly to a lot of his fans who don't remember this far back, in the 60s, Carlin was a pretty clean-cut, suit and tie sort of, comedian who was angling as best he could for television appearances. And he got his break on the Merv Griffin show and, soon became a regular performer on Ed Sullivan and on The Tonight Show, doing pretty squeaky clean material. I mean, he did, he came out with the Hippy Dippy Weatherman, but it was so benign at the time that a lot of people didn't realize the guy was supposed to be a stoner. He was just, just seemed like he was kind of daft. So Carlin was a pretty squeaky clean comedian, and then he sort of realized by the late 60s a couple things. He realized that he originally thought in his career that he was pushing towards taking stand-up comedy to the place where most stand-up comedians take it, which is as a stepping stone towards a career as either a sitcom star or a comic movie actor. And when Carlin got his first couple roles on sitcoms and in movies, he realized, you know what? I'm a lousy actor. I really don't have any right to be on stage as an actor trying to portray either a heightened version of myself or another character altogether. What I'm good at is talking from my own heart and mind about my own opinions about the world as a stand-up comedian. So he, almost alone among all major comedians of the last 50 years, really ended up devoting his entire life to stand-up comedy. We hear a lot about comedians like Jerry Seinfeld or Dave Chappelle or other comedians who go from stand-up comedy to television roles and sometimes into films and then, sort of say, I got to get back to my roots. I got to get back to stand-up comedy to make sure that I don't lose touch with that. And Carlin never lost touch with that. In fact, he always made his stand-up comedy first and foremost his priority. And in the early 70s, when he went through that transformation, he famously grew his hair long, grew a beard, thought he was going to have to stepped back from his career for a year, basically assumed he was going to have to give up a lot of the Hollywood and Las Vegas money that he had been taking in exchange for developing a new audience of, college-age students who would be a little more tuned in with the subjects that he wanted to speak about. But, the culture was ready for him. And so very quickly, within about 6 months or so, he went from playing some nightclubs right back to headlining theaters, around the country and getting, you know, back on the Tonight Show and all of that. So, you know, to my mind, George Carlin hosting the Tonight, guest hosting the Tonight Show for Johnny Carson in 1972, 73, 74 with a ponytail, with a tie-dye T-shirt on, went a long way towards teaching the older generation that at the time that the younger generation, like the seven words, in fact, was not necessarily something to fear, that, you know, there might be some redeeming social value, as it were, to the younger generation that up to that point had seemed like, you know, anathema to the older generation.
We're speaking with James Sullivan. We're talking about his new book called Seven Dirty Words, The Life and Crimes of George Carlin. Your book talks about George Carlin's childhood and gives some thoughts as to where his unique kind of comic sensibilities might have at least to some extent sprung. Although certainly we see him in the early part of his career as, in I think your words, a young man in search of his sense of humor. I mean, really trying to kind of sort things out. So by no means was George Carlin comedically full-formed as he entered early adulthood. One intriguing point you make in your book is that perhaps some of what he was about as a comedian had something to do with his relationship with his mother. I mean, this is something that he himself observed to possibly be an effect. Talk a moment about the smothering of the way in which his mother tended to kind of smother him a bit.
Right. Well, Carlin and his older brother grew up with a single mother on the Upper West Side of Manhattan in the Morningside Heights neighborhood, which is just around the Columbia University area. Carlin and his friends tended to prefer calling the neighborhood White Harlem because they thought it sounded tougher than Morningside Heights. He was kind of a classic street kid in the 40s in New York, but he was also, you know, going to parochial school, you know, on his Irish Catholic mother's request. Carlin's father had been a champion. He was a very successful newspaper advertising salesman. He could kind of sell the socks off of anybody and was a champion after-dinner speaker, but he was also a big-time drinker. And so by the time Carlin was born, his father was already on his way out the door, and Carlin never really got to know him very well. He understood that he got some of his gift of gab from his father, but also, you know, understood that he had no father figure in his life, which sort of led to him questioning other male authority figures throughout his life. But with regard to his mother very much looked at George as the baby of the two children, and, you know, her, you know, he was clearly bright as a kid, loved language, and his mother sort of wanted him to grow up to be the refined, cultured one of the two sons. And so she did. She smothered him as a child as much as she could, and he sort of rebelled against it from a young age. He was a streetwise kind of kid who hung around on the corners, got realized early on that he had a great capacity for mimicking, whether it was teachers or radio figures or the beat cop on the street corner. He would mimic these people, most of whom were authority figures, and make his friends laugh by making fun of them, by mimicking them. He got a tape recorder, a really big, bulky, early consumer version of a tape recorder, and started making tapes of himself and recordings of himself and played them back for his friends. His mother understood from George's young age that he was really very much interested in language, and whenever he would ask about a word, "Mom, what does this word mean?" she would say, "Well, let's go over to the dictionary and look it up." She constantly got him to look up words in the dictionary, and he clearly, not just the seven words, but you know, the whole language. I mean, a lot of his humor is very much inoffensive, silly. Looks at why do we phrase things the way we phrase them? Why do we have cliché? You know, what is it about clichés that makes them silly if you look at them in a certain light? And he was always analyzing language, holding it up and looking at it and trying to make sense of it and trying to, you know, figure out what was funny about it. And his mother really gave him that. But, you know, his mother showed up at Carlin's honeymoon, among other things. Him and his wife were in Florida trying to have a honeymoon. His mother showed up during the honeymoon. She ended up living with the family for long stretches of the 70s when they moved out to California. And she sort of was, on top of him all the time. And he felt like a lot of his comedy was about trying to get out from under his mother's thumb and also out from under the memory of this father that he never really knew. His comedy came from, and on top of that, the parochial school and, a lot of other factors really, added to the fact that he knew that his comedy was always about questioning authority.
Right. And I really think it's very astute of him to say at one point, as you quote, in talking about his mother's smothering instincts, mm-hmm. I had to fight her off. And it made me stronger.
Right.
And, of course, not everybody responds to an overprotective mother in that sort of fashion. Some give in and luxuriate in it. And in the case of George Carlin, he kind of bridled against it. And that was at least one ingredient in his makeup.
Right. Well, when he was first on television, he wore the tie, and he kind of did it because he figured his mother would want him to. And, she would say, you look presentable, George. And then... when he grew his hair long and started doing the seven words routine, she was outraged, and he sort of felt, that was another vindication for him. Of course, my mother should be outraged. That's what I'm, on some base level, that's kind of what I'm trying to achieve here.
Hmm. I think this might be a good moment to mention another reference to Wisconsin in your book, mm-hmm. which also refers to George Carlin's mother trying to come to terms with this son of hers and some of the shocking things which he did on stage and mm-hmm. on screen. It involves something that actually also ties into to this area when Mary Carlin, George Carlin's mother, encountered some nuns mm-hmm. who are part of the Cincinnati Dominicans. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I've been to Cincinnati. I know that beautiful place well, just outside of Dubuque. And right up the road from our studio in Racine is the Siena Center, which also has Dominican nuns of this same order.
Mm-hmm.
And oddly enough, it was some of these Dominican nuns who helped Mary Carlin come to terms with her son's comedy.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, so the parochial school experience that he had in New York City happened to be the staff was made up of Cincinnati nuns, and the director of the school had took the John Dewey approach to education, very progressive. So in the 1940s, this was unusual, certainly in a parochial school in New York City. So what Carlin often said later in life was that oddly, although he went through Catholic school, he had, what turned out to be the good fortune to go to a very progressive-minded Catholic school where the nuns and fathers were interested in teaching the children to question all received wisdom, to use the Socratic method, to say, if we understand X to be true, how do we know it to be? Who says it's true, and why do we believe it to be so? Not taking received wisdom without questioning it. And so Carlin joked often later on that, the nuns in particular, taught him to question the very institution that they were trying to indoctrinate him into, which was Catholicism, obviously. And he appreciated it. He really did. I mean, the Class Clown album, which was sort of his breakthrough album, which has the seven words routine on it, he very sincerely thanked the priest and the nuns of his grade school for helping him, create his worldview. And when he first played Carnegie Hall, when his career was really taking off in the early 70s, it was a big moment for his mother, who couldn't have been prouder that her son was playing Carnegie Hall. But sometime around that show, when she was walking on the street in her neighborhood and saw a couple of the nuns from the school, she stopped to say hello, and she said, they said, oh, we want to congratulate you on how well George's career is going. And she said, yeah, it's great, except that I really wish he just wouldn't use the dirty words. I mean, it's just really bothering me that he has to do that in his comedy. Why does he have to, use such foul language? And the nun said, oh, no, Mrs. Carlin, he's educating people. He is questioning the nature of language, and we feel it's perfectly appropriate for him to do it that way. He's not just gratuitously using the words. And, she sort of beamed and walked away from that encounter feeling like, okay, now, for her own son's career, which she felt like, well, geez, if he's got to be well-known, I wish it wasn't for this sort of offensive material. She sort of had another thought about that for the rest of her life afterwards, because the nuns had essentially validated it for her.
Hmm. We're speaking with James Sullivan about his book, Seven Dirty Words, The Life and Crimes of George Carlin. We read your book to get a sense of how George Carlin's career unfolds, and probably one of the most important things we learn from your book, when we think about someone like George Carlin, who, of course, is now, not that long after his death, already regarded by so many people in really iconic, larger-than-life terms. Mm-hmm. But in fact, as we read your book and follow his career, we realize that it was really kind of a bumpy career. I mean, this was by no means a smooth, steady ascent towards greatness.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, we get this sense in the when he first was quite prominent in the 60s, that this was somebody who was often in situations where he wasn't necessarily fully comfortable in his, and sort of the comedy inside of him waiting to come out was mm-hmm. was not really, it wasn't the forum for that. Just speak a moment about some of these various vehicles in which George Carlin found himself, and probably in sometimes rather uncomfortable circumstances.
Mm-hmm. I think he knew from a young, I'm sure he knew from a young age that he had a twisted kind of sense of humor, but he also sort of like suppressed that, especially when he was working in Greenwich Village in the mid-60s, because Greenwich Village at the time was a real proving ground for up-and-coming comedians, because they all knew, a large part of the television industry was still based at the time in New York. And so the Greenwich Village folk clubs, which also tended at the time to, you know, the folk clubs were not just folk music, they around that time they tended to have comedians followed by jugglers, followed by, you know, show tune singers, followed by a folk musician, and then another comedian. And the television shows were constantly scouring those clubs for potential talent to put on the air. And so Carlin was, you know, his career sort of got off the ground parallel to the careers of people like Woody Allen and Bill Cosby and Richard Pryor and Joan Rivers, all of whom were young comedians trying to make a name for themselves, trying to get noticed by television producers in the 60s. And Carlin, you know, oddly enough, you'd think that in Greenwich Village he would have really been pushing his Lenny Bruce material, type material, but he was really trying to craft a handful of routines that would be television ready and, you know, would appeal to a wide audience. And he succeeded in doing that, got the attention of producers at the Merv Griffin Show, as I mentioned earlier. And, you know, his career sort of went quickly from there. He moved out to California, found himself on a couple of variety shows as, you know, sort of a co-host or a recurring a performer. Got a role in a movie with, of all people, starring Doris Day. And he played sort of, he had a hammy, very hammy role as a bit player in this movie. And, you know, sort of started quickly to sour on this path, as I mentioned earlier, about moving from stand-up comedy to Hollywood and the movies and television. Mm. And then he started getting pretty lucrative gigs as an opening act for big-time singers in Las Vegas. And this was towards the very end of the 60s. And these couple of incidents really sort of opened his eyes a couple different times on a couple different occasions. He used a couple of words on stage, you know, to paying audiences of, you know, consenting adults. He used the couple of words on the very much on the milder end of the seven dirty words spectrum, and in both cases got reprimanded by his the people who, you know, who had hired him to play the nightclubs and casinos, and was sent home on the second occasion. You know, they said, take your pay, but don't come back for the rest of the week. And after the second time, he sort of realized, you know, what am I doing here? And he had been looking around and had been, you know, following closely. He'd been befriending folk musicians and rock musicians and, you know, clearly knew that the culture was changing, and started realizing at the time he was about 33 years old, and he was kind of right in the middle, because he felt like the audience that was watching him on the Ed Sullivan Show and the audiences that were coming to see him in Las Vegas were, you know, in their 40s or 50s, you know, a parent's generation. And he was in his 30s, and the culture was moving towards the attitudes and opinions of the people who were in their 20s and the college students. So he felt like he was right in the middle, and he sort of felt like he was doing a disservice to himself by catering his career up to that point towards the 40-somethings, the people that were 10 or 15 years older than him. He realized that his better audience was probably going to be the people that were younger than him, 10 or 15 years younger than him.
One of the stories you tell is about a moment in his Las Vegas career where he is part of one of the last acts that closes some famous place, and the next place he played was off the beaten track, still in Las Vegas, but kind of one of the sort of the side streets, a smaller place where, in effect, people who went there would be seeking him out because they loved George Carlin, versus playing some of these big, huge places where it was just kind of sort of a more of a generic touristy crowd who necessarily wouldn't be on his wavelength at all.
And that was much later in his career when he, Carlin, you know, for years said, I'm never going to play Las Vegas again. It's just not for me. You know, I'd much prefer to stay on the road where, you know, if I show up in your town and you're interested in my humor and what I have to say, you're going to make the effort to come see me. Whereas in Vegas, you know, as he said, it's just, as you said, it's just, you know, it tends to be people, you know, are staying in the hotel above the casino and they're looking for something to do and they kind of fall into the casino and say, let's just go see whatever the entertainment is tonight. And so he was experiencing people, you know, sort of heckling or getting up and leaving if they found themselves offended in those years in the early 1970s. And he kind of swore off Las Vegas and said he'd never do it again. However, for comedians, there is no more lucrative gig than playing in Vegas, and it's also a lot less grueling than being on the road constantly. You know, you can set up shop in town for a week or a month, a long engagement, and, you know, just, you know, rent somebody's house or stay in a suite or whatever and stay in the same place for, you know, weeks on end and show up at the same place every night and get paid extremely well. So a decade or two before his death, Carlin sort of resolved his issues with Vegas and said, I'm going to go back. But that was one of the things that he did. He pointedly went, you know, he bounced from a couple of different nightclubs, but he had long-term engagements with a couple of different places over the last couple decades or so of his life. And he did try to make sure that he made arrangements with casinos that were, as you said, slightly off the beaten path so that people would have to get, you know, make the effort to come see him, because if they did that, then he felt like they were pretty clearly committed to a George Carlin show.
Right. Oddly enough, one of the most astute observations about him, this is now back in the, I guess, early 70s when he's part of one of these kind of glitzy variety shows that is so, in many ways, counter to who he is, the Kraft Summer Music Hall, which was headlined by none other than John Davidson. I mean, it's just hard to get our heads around those two being involved in the same project. But one of the things you quote John Davidson saying about George Carlin is he seemed to be always festering. You could tell there was much, much more behind what he was saying. And obviously, the venue in which George Carlin, in some respects, could finally be himself and let everything out was when the new world of cable programming opened up, and specifically HBO. Right. Tell us what this new venture, this new platform meant to George Carlin.
Right. Well, it meant everything to his career because, you know, Carlin, in the early 70s, he became, you know, essentially a household name as an entertainer for the, you know, not just for the seven words routine, but he was, you know, well known for his Tonight Show guest hosting appearances and all of that. He, to my mind, he became the first rock star comedian. I mean, he was out of the comedy clubs and headlining theaters long before most of the comedians that we think of today as the ones, you know, Steve Martin in the late 70s, you know, springs immediately to mind, where he was able to fill big auditoriums like a rock band would with his comedy. Carlin was doing that before just about anybody. But by the late 70s, he was kind of flagging a little bit. He didn't really have a great idea about what the next direction for his comedy would be. He was doing a lot of observational material, just silly stuff, sort of like what Jerry Seinfeld would end up doing 20 years or so later. And was, you know, by his own admission, getting more heavily into drugs, and that was affecting his professionalism by the late 70s. And he wasn't quite sure where his career was headed and was floundering a little bit. And when HBO came around, and they targeted Carlin from very early on. HBO realized early on that as a subscription service, one of the things they wanted to do was offer their paying subscribers material that would not otherwise be available to them on network television. And HBO targeted a few areas as key to the buildup of their business. And one was boxing, which, you know, there were sort of, you know, afternoon fights on ABC Wide World of Sports on Saturdays or whatever, but, you know, there were plenty of fights that were not broadcast on TV, and then HBO started showing them. And another was live comedy, which, you know, you'd see a three-minute bit by a comedian on The Tonight Show, but you never saw a full hour or hour-and-a-half long set by a stand-up comedian as you would in a venue. So what HBO wanted to do was bring theatrical entertainment, live entertainment from theaters into the home, and comedy and boxing were its first two targets. Hmm. And Carlin was one of the first comedians that they wanted to have on. HBO created a comedy special, and a lot of the big-name comedians did it. And when Carlin started doing it in 1977, he never looked back.
Hmm.
Sorry, go ahead.
I like the parallel that you draw, too, about how there was comedy had a rawness that suited the new venture of HBO. Both boxing and comedy featured lone gladiators in the spotlight.
Right.
So, and you quote George Carlin as saying that what was so wonderful about this stage for him was that it provided for comedians three freedoms. He called it the Comedian's Bill of Rights: the freedom for stand-up comics to choose their own topics, freedom from commercial interruption, and freedom to use the entire language. And, of course, for George Carlin, that was like heaven on earth.
And the other thing it did for him was that, you know, he ended up doing 14 HBO specials over the last 30 years or so of his life. So that's roughly one every 2 years. What it did for him was gave him, you know, I said he was floundering a little bit, looking for direction by the late 70s. You know, one of the first things he did was, well, he started having a couple of heart attacks, and it forced him to clean his health up. You know, he got straight as far as hard drugs were concerned. But HBO gave him that new sense of direction that he was looking for. Once he realized that they were going to ask him back every, you know, couple of years to do another special, he had a whole new platform for an hour or an hour and a half's worth of new material. So it gave him drive that, as a writer, that he maybe was losing by the late 70s.
Sure.
He realized every couple of years, I need to have a full set of brand new material, and no longer could a comedian, you know, sort of base his entire career on, you know, Henny Youngman's one-liners, or, you know, Milton Berle dressing in a woman's dress, and, you know, and getting laughs for the same thing again and again. You know, to Carlin's mind, it was comedy was a writer's craft, and he was writing a full slate of new material every 2 years for every HBO special up till the end of his life.
And you wrote, constantly looming HBO deadlines had forced the comedian to write new material with the rigor of an athlete in training.
Mm-hmm.
So there are these HBO specials, some of which can be still viewed and enjoyed, many, many books, the comedy albums, so much fascinating legacy, entertaining legacy, which George Carlin leaves behind him, all discussed in fascinating detail in your wonderful book, which also explores some of his personal issues, substance troubles, the strength he exerted in leaving at least some of that behind him, and much of the personal side of this fascinating man, George Carlin. The book, again, is called Seven Dirty Words, The Life and Crimes of George Carlin. It's published by DaCapo Press and written by James Sullivan. James Sullivan, I thank you so much for this endlessly fascinating book and for this chance for me to talk with you on The Morning Show. I have enjoyed this.
Well, thanks, Greg. So have I.
Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois is for partly cloudy skies with a high temperature today of 39 degrees. Cloudy overnight with a low of 29 degrees. Partly sunny tomorrow, warming to 43 degrees for a high temperature. It will be cloudy on Wednesday with a 40% chance of rain mixed with a little snow. Wednesday's high 39 degrees, a little colder Thursday and Friday with sunshine and the low 30s for a high. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. And